Now we ask, what is so new about that? Meanwhile, Russia has reacted and has accused the U.S.-led NATO of aggressive containment of Russia. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll review the NATO summit's communique, which also includes how it has described China of being a threat to the world order.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western military alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats, and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kyiv with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, an international human rights and labor lawyer, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Kent Stone, from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, who joins us from Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken Stone, I'm going to first start with you. What do you think about the name New Force Model, which NATO describes as a new strategic blueprint in which the U.S.-led NATO is referring to Russia based on this as a direct threat to the security of the member states? And then my question to you is, what is so new about this? And even if it's true, who provoked this sentiment for Russia to become, as they perceive, a security threat?
Well, it's not new at all. As a matter of fact, when Lester B. Pearson, who was Foreign Minister of Canada, proposed the formation of NATO before 1949, his view was to bring down socialism in the former Soviet Union and to actually bring down the Soviet Union. So NATO has been a threat, an existential threat to Russia for 70 years. And once the Soviet Union dissolved itself, rather than dissolving NATO, which was supposed to be dealing with a supposed Russian threat, NATO went on the warpath and showed its true colors. It is the aggressive military alliance led by the United States, which promptly in the 1990s went against the former Yugoslavian Federation. It attacked it, bombed it for 78 days, and destroyed it, and swallowed up its component parts. Then it went after Afghanistan, and then it went after Iraq, and then it went after Libya. So the U.S. Has NATO in its pocket as an aggressive military alliance. The U.S., when the Soviet Union dissolved itself, wanted to become the only superpower in a unipolar world, and that's what they're trying to do today in Madrid. They are saying that Russia is the enemy, and Russia does not want to be seen as its enemy.
Okay.
Okay.
You make some good points there. I'd like to, however, move on to this timeline, Daniel Kovalik, which was highlighted just a few weeks back, and that is the fact that this war passed 100 days. And that was obviously a very grim milestone in a sense. But in reality, this war has been going on now for 8 years, hasn't it? And if you want to even go further than that, we can, because Russia has been seeing NATO's eastward expansion for all this time, hasn't it? It's been provoked, whether directly by NATO and its moves, but even more so maybe by the U.S. in terms of the way that it has treated Russia in terms of sanctions, in terms of just making it and a national security threat based on the way that the U.S. sees it. So is it a surprise that Russia has acted out the way that it did? Again, I need to make a note here that we are not for war. We're not advocating war by this question. But, you know, when you push somebody so much for such a length of time, then my question to you is it a surprise that Russia has acted out?
No, and I've written about this. I mean, first of all, I've been writing about this for years, that this was a risk, that eventually Russia probably would react the way they did because of, as you say, NATO expansion that really began in earnest under William Jefferson Clinton, even after numerous promises were made by James Baker and others that NATO would not move an inch east of Germany if the Berlin Wall came down, which it did. But the U.S. and NATO never upheld their part of that bargain. And you mentioned, of course, in 2014, the coup against the government in Ukraine, which the U.S. was behind, and the U.S. backed ultra-right wing forces that very quickly made it clear that they wanted to ethnically cleanse the ethnic Russian population from the eastern part of Ukraine. We see the New York Times in the past week has said what a lot of us have known for a while, that the CIA has been operating in Ukraine for some time, training and giving logistical support to armed forces that target Russians in Ukraine. So really what's happened in Madrid is simply an announcement of a position of a strategy that's existed for a long time, which has been the dismantling of Russia. I think that, you know, in the light of day now, as the years have passed, we can now honestly and truthfully say that the Cold War never really ended, that the Russians fully expected it would end with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc in 1991. But for the West, it never ended, that was not enough, that it wasn't just about communism. It was about Russia as well. And it was about China as well as potential adversaries. And now we know this. And now NATO is being very clear that their intention is to drive Russia into the ground.
Well, Kent Stone, when you take a look, I referred to a timeline there to Daniel Kovalik. when you take a look at the length of this war, the way that the U.S. has approached it in particular, and then you take a look at what has happened in this summit, where NATO felt that there needs to be a new rejuvenate this anti-Russia sentiment in a new form. It's almost like it's being reintroduced. Is there a possibility that they're doing that because they want to make sure that the threat or the perceived threat of Russia still exists among member states led by the U.S., which is ramping up, in a sense, scaremongering, so that that remains and people or the countries don't falter from that course?
Well, it's clear to me and to people in the peace movement that what NATO is doing in Ukraine is to march NATO up to the borders of Russia, of the Russian Federation, and do to Russia what it did to the former Yugoslavia. That is to say, to defeat it militarily and then to dismember it, the better to gobble it up. It's part of the U.S. plan, with the help of its military alliance, NATO, to achieve hegemony over the entire world. After they supposedly get the defeat of Russia and the dismemberment of the Russian Federation, then they will move on to China. That's the plan. And it should be clear to everyone in the world. It's clear to us here in the peace movement, and it's clear to people who are demonstrating in Madrid today and having counter summits, and it's clear to the workers who are in Spain and Greece and other countries who are preventing supplies, military equipment of NATO going to Ukraine, that the NATO has, and U.S. of course, has a warlike agenda. Their plans to expand their strike force, to label Russia as an adversary, and to label China as a threat is clearly antagonistic to our desire to have a peaceful world where all countries are their sovereignty is treated with respect. But that's not the case with NATO. When the U.S. decides that it wants to force a country to yield its energy resources, as in the case of Libya, or its strategic position in the case of Afghanistan, it unleashes NATO upon that country and creates havoc. It destroys whole countries and turns their population into refugees. And this is what we've seen over and over again in the past 30 years. And yes, the U.S. is trying to marshal its European vassals, and I say vassals because they can be herded, even though it's like herding cats. They can be herded and turned against an alleged enemy of the U.S. on the snap of its fingers, and they can even be persuaded to impose sanctions which cripple themselves rather than the supposed target. Right. There's going to be terrible results in Europe and North America as a result of the sanctions that have been leveled against Russia. And that's why we've been demonstrating this week all across Canada against NATO, demanding Canada get out of NATO, demanding that NATO disband, and that there should not be a new arms race, which is being provoked by NATO, by sending all these arms into Ukraine, and to insist on countries like Canada upping its military spending to 2%. In Canada, it means a 70% increase in military spending. It's outrageous.
Well, we're looking again at what the U.S. President Joe Biden has said, Daniel Kovalik, in terms of pledging more military aid, in terms of more, things like warplanes and warships for Europe. $5 billion in U.S. aid, or maybe a little more than that, has been pledged during the Biden administration. But at the same time, we're seeing that Russia is not losing the war. Russia is going ahead with what it's doing, especially in the Donbass region. And it's interesting how NATO nor the U.S. are really even stating that Ukraine is actually being defeated. Why then is the U.S. first, then the NATO partner countries, sending more weapons and pledging more aid when Ukraine is being defeated. What does that say?
Well, we know why. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, about 6 weeks ago, I guess it was, made it very clear that the goal in Ukraine is to weaken Russia. That is to say, the U.S. will continue to support the war effort in Ukraine, regardless of whether Ukraine can win or not. They can't.
Well, tell us what you think he means when he says weaken Russia. You either weaken a country that's at war by either killing their soldiers or for that country to run out of ammunition. Which is it?
Well, I think they want to kill their soldiers. They want to continue to have U.S. or Russia send soldiers to Ukraine and be killed. And yes, they want them to use up weaponry. They want their government to spend their revenue, of course, some of which the U.S. has stolen, on weapons and soldiers instead of on the economy and building up the economy and putting money into social programs. This is exactly the strategy that the U.S. openly, or at least after the fact, admitted, Brzezinski admitted openly later, that they used against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The goal in Afghanistan in the 80s was to draw the Soviet Union into a war that would undermine and destroy the Soviet Union. In the words of Brzezinski, he wanted to give the Soviet Union its Vietnam, referring, of course, to the U.S. war in Vietnam, which was very destructive of the United States. And that's exactly what happened. And it did, in fact, help to weaken and ultimately destroy the Soviet Union. This is exactly the same game plan. They wanted this war. They provoked this war. Even the Pope has said that probably this war was provoked by the U.S. and NATO. They wanted to do that. They wanted Russia to intervene. And they want to extend this war as long as possible to undermine and, if they could, destroy Russia. And they don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainians. They will fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. That is what is very clear.
Well, let's see here. Let's refer Ken Stone to what the U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said. And let me get your reaction on this, on your reading into this. He said that Zelensky wanted to pretty much secure an advantageous position in this conflict with Russia in months. By the end of the year, it turned out was what Zelensky was referring to, rather than years. That's coming from the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan. What does that say when Jake Sullivan makes that statement, when he says in months is what Zelensky wants rather than years, which is what the U.S. has in mind?
Well, like our Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, the U.S. Leaders have made it clear that what they want to achieve in Ukraine, as Dan Kovalik has correctly pointed out, is to defeat Russia. And Chrystia Freeland used the words vanquish Russia and defeat it. She said that while she was donating $500 million of Canadians' taxpayers' money to Ukraine. And in addition to that, they've sent several billion dollars worth of military equipment and other kinds of funding to Ukraine. And the purpose of this is to bring about the defeat of Russia. It's the opposite. It shows that the U.S. and NATO, Canada, and all the other NATO allies have an aggressive agenda here. And they're not about to look for peace with Russia. They've encouraged Mr. Zelensky and his government to continue fighting rather than bring about de-escalation, rather than fueling the conflict with arms and funding. And now Canadian Special Forces, according to the New York Times, are in Ukraine. And we were at the minister's office in Oakville yesterday, the defense minister's office, and she doesn't deny the fact that they're there. So they're there. And so Canada is de facto at war with Russia right now because we have boots on the ground in Ukraine. It's an aggressive war. What the opposite of all this would be, as the Russians argue, there should be a mutual security system in Europe such that the security of one state doesn't impinge upon the security of others. If all the states got together and achieved a collective or a mutual security system, we could have peace. But that's not on the agenda for the U.S. and NATO. This is clearly an aggressive move, an escalation, which brings us closer to the unthinkable, as your earlier report said. It brings us closer to a nuclear confrontation between nuclear powers. And that's something that could bring about the end, that would bring about the end of human civilization. So we should think, people across the world are thinking about the danger of this. And that's why people are in the streets, because they don't want this U.S. aggressive action in Ukraine and in Madrid to strengthen NATO to bring about the end of their lives and their children's lives.
Indeed. Well, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. Daniel Kovalev, Kent Stone talks about this unified security apparatus of some kind to be agreed upon, as Russia has proposed, so that there could be a mutual approach towards this conflict. But when you have Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, talk about how this war is going to end on the negotiating table, and at the same breath, he says, only on the condition that Ukraine gets what it wants. I repeat, Ukraine gets what it wants. And that depends on the gains on the battlefield. How can you have a unified strategy of security when the other side is talking about what I just said?
This has never been about security. Not national security, not the security of the EU. Russia's never been a threat to the EU or to the United States. In fact, we have to be reminded that Putin was the first world leader to call George W. Bush after 9/11, offer condolences, offer help in the war on terror. Russia always wanted to work with the West. This is not about security. This is about the West's desire to create insecurity in Russia, to destroy Russia. That's what this is about. This has nothing to do with the EU protecting its own security. In fact, just the opposite. The sanctions have backfired on the EU. They are making the EU more insecure. They're going to be lucky if they can heat their homes come this winter.
Exactly. I'm going to have to jump in, unfortunately. Daniel Kovalev, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry. Daniel Kovalev, the international human rights and labor lawyer. Thank you, from Pittsburgh, PA. Kent Stone, Canada, out of NATO. I see your pin. We got the message. Thank you. Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, from Hamilton, Ontario. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner and its spiritual effects. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the good manner and its spiritual or the effects that we see in hereafter. When we talk about something, obviously we in Islam talk about its two aspects. One, its worldly effects and its effects in hereafter, or the spiritual effect. The material effect that we can see, that we can experience in this world. And there are some spiritual effects as well, because Islam talks about hereafter. There is a paradise, there is a reward, there is a punishment. Therefore, when we look at the good manner, we must look at its spiritual effects as well, its effects in hereafter, What are the effects? And when we see in the Islamic teachings, we see that those who have good manner about them, the Prophet ﷺ has said that this having a good manner takes them towards the higher ranks of spirituality. It helps them to achieve the most highest ranks of the spirituality, which an ordinary person cannot reach, which a person, if he prays all the day and he fasts all the day and the whole night, if he stands and he prays Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he cannot reach to that rank if he does not have the good manner, if he is not capable of a good manner. Therefore, it is necessary to have a good manner. Why? Because if we want to reach to the perfection, to gain the higher ranks, even in hereafter or the higher ranks in the paradise, it is necessary to have a good manner. And the second benefit is that it eases the accounts that we have. Obviously, on the day of punishment, we are accountable for many things. Therefore, when Allah puts us accountable for our deeds, if a person has a good manner, it becomes easy in hereafter. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the good manner and its spiritual effects, its effects in hereafter, and we counted two of them. Number one is it helps us in gaining the high ranks. The other is it makes our accounts easy in hereafter. And the third effect, the spiritual effect that we're going to talk about, is that the husn-e khulq or the good manner helps us in the forgiveness of the sins. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has said that inna al-khulq al-hasan, the good manner, yumitu al-khati'a, it takes away the mistakes that a person does. And it basically takes away. And if a person has a good manner, this good manner, even if it has small mistakes, if he has performed some sins, because of this good manner, because people are happy of him, because his family is happy from him, because the people, creatures, which were created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, all of them are happy. They do not have any kind of complaint against him. Because they are happy, therefore Allah forgives his mistakes if he has performed any kind of mistakes. So Allah forgives his sins. And this is one of the benefits. This is the third benefit. And the fourth benefit that a person has is that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said that أَكْثَرُ مَا تَلَجُ بِهِ أُمَّتِي الْجَنَّةِ تَقْوَى اللَّهِ وَحُسْنُ الْخُلْقِ. The most of the people who will enter the paradise are those who have the God very and who are having the good manner. So most of the people who are entering the paradise, they entered the paradise because of two things. Number one, they God very, they have fear of Allah. Number two, they have a good manner. And this is the good manner that most of the people in the nation of the Prophet ﷺ, if they have this characteristics, they will enter the paradise, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Tehran, the capital of Iran, and now a destination for investors. Tehran Investment Summit brought together businesses, mayors, and urban development officials from Iran and the world to explore areas of investment in Tehran.
It's so important for us to participate in here, and we consider as a not only for a relationship between two cities, it's in the, including for the relationship between two countries.
2 years ago, the Iranian and Nicaraguan capitals, Tehran and Managua, signed an MOU that named them as sister cities. Now, with the Tehran Investment Summit, there is a chance for Managua to further cooperate with Tehran in launching urban development projects.
210 projects covering waste management, transport, and tourism, among others, will be introduced to investors in the two-day conference. The projects total roughly $71 billion. Tehran municipality says if those projects are accomplished, they will revolutionize the Iranian capital.
This is the start of a turning point in Tehran's development. This conference was inaugurated today, but it has no closing ceremony. The exhibition section of the event will continue to run permanently to highlight any area that needs investment. This will transform Tehran's future.
Being among the busiest cities means that Tehran is inevitably among the most polluted places in the world. Municipal authorities say they also welcome any investment in controlling air pollution in Tehran.
Eliminating air pollution and traffic congestions are among the major challenges in Tehran, which can be solved permanently through the promotion of clean transportation. I'm certain that many investors would love to invest in this area.
Attracting foreign investment has long been a challenge for Iran as a result of U.S. sanctions that restrict global banking transactions with Iran.
I would not say that sanctions will not affect foreign investment, but we are focusing on the private sector, which acts separately from governments. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Iran has also promised to support foreign investors should they take part in Tehran's development projects.
Life in the Iranian capital is a mixed experience of modernity and antiquity, as it's home to both skyscrapers and historic buildings, together making it a hot tourist target. But tourism is only one of the countless capacities for investment in Tehran, as it's home to some 15 million residents, and with a large population comes a wide array of interests and businesses.
As the capital of Iran, Tehran has numerous opportunities for investors, from tourism to transport and pollution control projects. Many of those projects have so far been running based on citizen participation or tax revenues. Now, Tehran municipality says with its approach shifting toward investment, the development of the metropolis is expected to accelerate. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his Health Secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
Nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognize over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologize for it. I think in hindsight, it was the wrong thing to do. I apologize to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. I like Boris as a friend. I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in free fall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saipur is up, London.
Iran's embassy in Lebanon held a ceremony to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the abduction of four Iranian nationals in Lebanon. Iranian ambassador to Lebanon lauded the four men as messengers of peace to Lebanon, noting that Israel was behind their abduction.
We are pursuing the case of our four diplomats via diplomatic and legal means, as their fate is very important for us. This ceremony is being held to honor and remember our diplomats, and it helps us shed light on the fate of our kidnapped diplomats. We have repeatedly said that we have documents and evidence showing our diplomats were handed over to the Israeli regime following their abduction. Israel is politically and legally held accountable for their abduction. We will pursue their case until their fate is known.
A military attaché at Tehran's embassy in Beirut, Ahmad Mutavassilian, along with Iranian charge d'affaires in Lebanon, Mohsen Mousavi, an employee of the embassy, Taqir Asdiqar Muqaddam, and a photographer for the Islamic Republic Agency, Qasem Akhavan, were abducted on July 4, 1982. Lebanese militiamen from the Lebanese Forces Group admitted to kidnapping the four men who were on a diplomatic mission in North Lebanon. Investigations show that they were last handed over to Israel at the time.
The legal follow-up of this case in the last few years proves without a doubt that these men were kidnapped on a militia checkpoint, and it was proven that they were put in the jails of that well-known militia which was collaborating with the occupation entity. There are testimonies that they were handled over to the occupation forces. The Lebanese government has a responsibility to follow up the case to highest levels, including the International Criminal Court.
Those in attendance called for an objective investigation by the United Nations and the International Red Cross. Although there is information about those who abducted the Iranian diplomats and their whereabouts, the fate of these Iranians remains shrouded in mystery. The families and Iranian officials believe they remain detained in Israeli jails. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
British Indians flocked to central London Sunday to condemn India's ruling government over its failures to protect Indian minorities from persecution. The anger comes after a string of incidents saw huge numbers of India's 204 million Muslims turn against the authorities, which Muslims claim are systematically discriminating against them.
Violence and discriminatory rhetoric against minorities in India has become so commonplace that many onlookers fear that a genocide may be on the horizon. Muslims in particular are fearful, given that Islamophobic hate crimes have run rampant in India.
Accusations against New Delhi include allowing sectarian attacks on mosques, failing to stop anti-Muslim lynch mobs, hijab bans, and the bulldozing of homes in Muslim areas, essentially a type of ethnic cleansing.
What's happened to minorities in India, if you don't know, is it is on the brink of genocide. This peaceful demonstration is not against India. I want to repeat, it's not against India, it's against the government of India. They are not doing anything. They are complacent. They are basically wanting to make India into a Hindu Rashtra and move away from democracy.
I think that it's wrong that there should be hijab bans. It's wrong that people should be persecuted for interfaith relationships. It's wrong that Indian Muslim homes are bulldozed. And it's wrong, as we saw with Indian farmers, that there's state sanction, sedition and suppression of rights and views and peaceful protests.
India's Prime Minister, who heads the ruling BJP party, has been accused of pushing an extremist Hindu nationalism, which preaches intolerance of other religious groups. Under Narendra Modi's watch, India has been routinely condemned by human rights groups over anti-Muslim discrimination, but the attention of Western leaders has been more focused on building trade with India to help combat economic instability. And that is why, so far, concerns by Muslims in India have fallen mostly on deaf ears. Robert Carter, London.
Donetsk is on fire. The Ukrainian army has been bombing civilian areas of this city for 3 straight days. We travelled to one of the areas hit yesterday and this morning. Markets are common targets for the Ukrainians, presumably because they are more likely to kill, and in the hope of breaking the will of the Donbass people who support Russia.
How can they kill civilians? It's awful. What are they doing? What purpose are they doing it for? We didn't do anything to them. We need peace. We need to work, to raise our children. Terrible things are going on. We have to sit in basements without food or water. We need peace.
Now, our driver has just told us to hurry up. Indeed, one of the women we interviewed also told us afterwards to get out of here quickly, as there could be more incoming. Now, while it's quiet at the moment in Donetsk, frankly, you can be hit anywhere at any time. The hotel behind the market is still on fire. It was hit this morning. Locals tell me the same place is often bombed hours later in the hope of killing those who come to inspect the damage. A piece of deadly shrapnel lies on the road. Now, I've just entered a residential area just adjacent to the market. We've heard that there were a couple of people killed here earlier. A shell pounding the apartments with shrapnel. A woman and her children appear at the window. She tells me it hit a couple of hours ago. Shrapnel smashed through her window. Now, we've just seen people running for shelter. We've just sheltered down ourselves as they've been incoming here. We heard the explosion a little bit, we're way off. But this area is still very dangerous. We strikes any time. Now we were going to try and find the woman, the 2 people killed, or relatives of them, but frankly my team has said we've got to get out of here, as it's just too dangerous. At the market, the anger amongst people is palpable. The women I speak to are visibly angry at me for being British.
You're scoundrels, those who kill civilians, children. More than 200 people have been killed in Donetsk these previous months, not to mention those wounded. So many children have died. It's outrageous. There's no forgiveness for this. They're killers. They're murdering ordinary people for the sake of their own interest. Why don't you look after your own country? All the best to you. What shall I tell my child? That I have no money and we have nothing to eat? That everything was sheltered here? What have you come here for? Do you give me any money? I have to provide for my child and live somehow. And where do I earn money now? I've been working here for 20 years. 20 years. And it's all over now.
Scenes like this are played out across the city every day now, as Western governments and media focus on alleged Russian war crimes. In Donetsk, Ukraine is getting away with murder. The guns and ammunition for these attacks are increasingly being paid by taxpayers in NATO countries. 3 were killed yesterday, 5 the day before, and already today, a 10-year-old girl has been killed. Under the almost constant crash of new explosions, Civilians are being slaughtered every day. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Tehran has organized the fourth edition of its International Conference on American Human Rights. The conference was attended by Iranian officials, experts, and the youth from over 50 countries. The event was held on the occasion of the American Human Rights Week in Iran. It reviewed the human rights situation worldwide and its challenges as a result of the United States' double standard policies. Addressing the event, Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights, Kazem Gharibabadi, said the U.S. is in no position to talk about human rights, given its widespread violations.
One can confidently claim that there is no nation in today's world that has not tasted the bitter taste of the American version of human rights. The U.S. administration should be held responsible to the oppressed peoples who have lost their lives as a result of terrorism, sanctions, aggression, and occupation.
The Iranian officials and experts believe that the gravest violation that can be committed against human rights is to politicize the issue, and this is exactly what the U.S. has done. A senior Iranian diplomat says human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for the expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism.
Today, human rights are turned into a pretext and a tool for expansion and institutionalization of the predominance of American unilateralism. Sanctions and terrorism are the main pillars of the American version of human rights. If they are robbed of these two pillars, they may not be able to continue their dominance and plots.
Analysts believe that the unilateral U.S. sanctions are a means of collective punishment of all people, without any exception.
Here in Iran, people believe that the title American Human Rights Week seeks to condemn Washington's double standard policies with regard to human rights and reveal this very reality to the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Protesters blocking lanes and taking part in slowdowns on busy roads across the UK.
Give us our country back!
Organized on social media by Fuel Price Stand Against Tax, they're demanding deeper cuts in fuel duty. Chancellor Rishi Sunak announced a 5 pence cut in March, but that has not meant much at the forecourts.
Fuel prices in the UK have hit record highs since the beginning of the year. Only a few months ago, it would have cost roughly $90 to fill up, let's say, a 50-litre tank. But now it'll cost $30 more to fill up that same tank.
And that has put the squeeze on the finances of people. Some have had to quit their jobs because they couldn't afford the commute anymore. Businesses, too, are feeling the pinch at the pump and are passing the extra costs onto the consumers, worsening the cost of living crisis.
Worst of all, the poorest are suffering the most. You can't just switch off your power, you can't switch off your car, you can't switch off your central heating. And when winter comes, people will freeze. All of that, a direct consequence of this government's failure to have a joined-up energy policy, and we are literally paying the consequences.
Among the biggest factors contributing to the fuel price hikes, the UK's green energy policy and Western sanctions on Russian energy exports in the wake of the Ukraine war. Sanctions that the UK government was among the first to impose.
The sanctions imposed upon Russia for political reasons have clearly pushed up the energy costs. But secondly, and even more importantly, Britain has an idiotic environmental policy where they import the very fossil fuels that they depend on, even though under our feet there are £1 trillion worth of gas, and in the North Sea there are billions of pounds worth of oil.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has hinted at a rise in UK oil and gas output, but critics say it would have little effect on consumer bills. And as long as the UK, along with its Western allies, fans the flames of the war in Ukraine, scenes like this may well become more frequent. Saeed Purizab, London.
Thousands of Iranian pilgrims have arrived in the holy city of Mecca for the Hajj pilgrimage. This once-in-a-lifetime journey requires spiritual as well as physical preparation. It's an arduous trip, and pilgrims usually start exercising prior to traveling to Mecca to enhance their fitness levels. However, what if pilgrims got sick or had an injury? To make sure Iranian pilgrims will receive proper and quick medical services during their Hajj pilgrimage, the Islamic Republic's Red Crescent Society has taken special measures. First, all Iranian pilgrims have checkups in the country to make sure they are healthy and in good physical condition. After receiving medical approval to travel to Saudi Arabia, each Hajj caravan is accompanied by a doctor.
Our goal is to bring back all Iranian pilgrims to our country in perfect health. We assure our pilgrims that during their journey, a medical team accompanies them, and in case of any problems, they will receive the required services.
Doctors accompany pilgrims in their hotels and provide outpatient services for them.
Three medical clinics operate 24/7. In addition, a well-equipped hospital in the city of Mecca is currently providing specialized services to Iranian pilgrims.
While so far there have been no cases of serious illnesses or injuries, Iranian doctors ask pilgrims to look after their health.
Older persons or those with underlying diseases should avoid going out in the hottest part of the day, and rather go out at times when outdoor air temperatures are cooler.
Pilgrims should also be cautious about getting infectious diseases and wear masks in gatherings and crowded places. Iran's medical team sent to Saudi Arabia has carried the title of the best team for several years, and the key to their success is the devotion and love of the medical staff.
God has blessed us with the opportunity to be here with a group of our friends. We enjoy the spiritual environment of Hajj and serve the pilgrims of Kaaba.
Serving the pilgrims of Kaaba is one of the biggest blessings that has been bestowed upon me in my life. It has been one of my biggest dreams. I hope to be a good servant for Hajj pilgrims.
Providing different services for Iranian Hajj pilgrims is not only a duty, but rather an honor. Mahdi Abbasian, Mecca.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be asking a question, a very simple question, and it nevertheless is a very profound and important and significant question. It's so simple, in fact, that a lot of times it passes over our mind. And that question is this. We know that in Islam, God is referred to as Allah, which is an Arabic term referenced in the Quran and the Hadith. The question is, what exactly is the meaning of the word Allah, right? We worship Allah, we pray, we fast, we read the Quran, we pray, we make dua to Allah, right? And we call on Him and ask for help, but we never really comes to mind and we never really ask, what exactly is the meaning of this word? And this is important and significant because unless we don't understand who we are addressing in our prayers, in our acts of worship, in our ibadat, then the significance and value of these acts of worship and ibadat will obviously not be equal to the time when we perform them and we execute them with the knowledge of the person and the being that we are addressing. This is the question we want to address today. Fortunately, we have an answer to this question in the very hadith and Quranic verses which have kind of tackled this question and have and answered it. For example, we have a hadith which has been narrated from Imam Ali, in which he has elucidated and clarified the meaning of the word Allah. Imam Ali says that Allah means the being who is the worshipped one, right? So in this term Allah, right, there is a dimension of being worshipped. Al-Ma'bud. Al-Ma'bud. Ma'bud means somebody who is the object of worship. Right? So this is one aspect which is contained in this word. Then in continuation, the Imam says, by whom people are bewildered. Alladhi ya'lahu fihi al-khalq. Meaning the people, this word is derived from the root word, which signifies being bewildered, right? So Allah is taken from this root word, in which signifies being bewildered in something, and therefore the word Allah refers to a being in whom people become bewildered, amazed at, not in the sense that they don't understand who he is or what he is or that he exists or something like that, but the fact that they're amazed and at awe at his, for example, his perfections and his infinitude and his limitlessness. Then the Imam says, and to whom they are submissive. Right? So this is a third kind of dimension, which is contained in the totality of the meaning of this term, that people are submissive to him, whether they want to be submissive to him or not. Right. So this is a submissiveness which is not at the level of free will. We're talking about a submissiveness which is involuntary. God is a being to whom all things are willingly or unwillingly submissive. For example, we have a verse in the Holy Quran which kind of refers to this. God Almighty says that we asked the mountains and the earth and the skies, we said, come to us willingly or unwillingly, right? And they said that we come to you unwillingly. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the meaning of the word Allah. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
What is happening in Palestine is not removed from what is happening in the US with its increased gun violence. The consequences of the gun lobby and weapons manufacturers in the US have destructive and deeply unjust consequences all over the world, including in the murder of Shirin Abu Aghaleh. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Yusra Bitar, writer. This article is published under the heading, Big Players in Finance Profited from Gun Used to Kill Shirin Abu Aghaleh. On May 11, 2022, Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh was killed. It is widely believed that she was intentionally targeted by the Zionist regime armed forces. A CNN investigation concluded that video evidence and witness testimony suggest that Abu Aghaleh was shot dead in a targeted attack by Israeli forces while doing her job and wearing a clearly marked press vest and helmet. Last week, the Palestinian Attorney General concluded in a new report that the bullet that killed Abu Aghle was a 5.56-millimeter round fired from a Roger Mini 14 semi-automatic rifle. The Connecticut-based company Sturm, Roger & Company Incorporation produces this Roger Mini. Roger was originally founded in 1949 to manufacture firearms for the commercial sporting market. Today, it is one of the largest publicly traded